Okay, Nathan, you're on.
Well, good evening. We're going to be continuing our study of the book of Esther, kind of going back to what we did on Sunday morning, if you can remember that far back, where we did something of a character study of Esther herself, and then drew some lessons out of that as we watched her character develop and saw how we could model that same kind of development in our lives as we grow into being the kind of people that our family and our congregations and so forth needs us to be, even when it's outside of our comfort zone and all of those kinds of things as we talked about before. Well, with Ahasuerus, the king of the book of Esther, it's a little bit different. He's not exactly an exemplary figure where you want to look at him and say, I'm going to do the same kinds of things that he did. He's also not the sort of character that grows over the course of the book of Esther. He's basically the same guy from beginning to end. But he is a fascinating character in a variety of ways when you stop and look at him and think about the things that he's doing. And so what we're going to do is look at Ahasuerus the way that we looked at Esther previously. Look at a variety of passages that show us various character traits about him. And in particular, focus on one specific thing that is going on in his life, what I've called here the evil of indifference, and try to draw some of that out to think about, kind of practically speaking, today. Now, I'm not sure how the timing of all of this is going to work out as far as the lesson goes. A lot of that is going to depend on whether I can keep myself from chasing too many side paths. But if I am able to do so, I might, at the end of the lesson for a few minutes, open up for some discussion, if that's an okay thing to do here. I hope so. And see what maybe you can bring to the idea of this evil of indifference and very practical ways of thinking about this, and kind of talk through it like that. And so, rather than meandering any further with this introduction, if we're going to have that time, I need to go ahead and get into the material. So, as you talk about Ahasuerus, I have referred to him already as a buffoon, and he is that in a variety of ways in the book. But what is it that makes him look like a buffoon in the book of Esther? And again, remember that this depiction of the king in the book of Esther is not a complete depiction of King Ahasuerus, the person who lived and ruled over the Persian Empire. That doesn't mean that it's inaccurate or that the author is lying to us. What he is doing is choosing certain character traits to emphasize in the telling of the story as a way of mocking Gentile pagan rulers, seems to be what he's doing. But what is it that he looks like in the book of Esther? Well, there are a variety of things in particular that you can't help but notice about this king. First of all, Ahasuerus is a very superficial person, which stands in a lot of contrast with the other characters in the book of Esther. Other characters in the book of Esther are much deeper than Ahasuerus is. As we talked about Esther herself on Sunday morning, she has deep personal thoughts and she works out a plan and strategizes. She's afraid in chapter 4. She takes courage in chapter 5. She's an intricate sort of person. So is Haman. He's not a likable person, but he's a deep sort of person. He schemes and he broods and he fantasizes about his own glory that he thinks he's going to get. And Mordecai is as well. Mordecai may be the deepest of all the characters because the narrator lets us in on so little about him. But he takes precautions and he makes plans. And the thing about Mordecai is the more you want to know what's going on in his mind, the less the narrator tells you. Which is just a fascinating thing. There are two really, really big questions that everybody would like to ask Mordecai. And if you haven't thought of them yet, you will want to ask Mordecai these questions eventually once you stop and think about it. Or maybe after I tell you what they are. And they are, first of all, why exactly did you tell Esther to hide her identity? That's a really interesting question. And there are a variety of reasons he might have done that, and we could speculate all day long, but the narrator doesn't even give us so much of as a hint of what his motivation was in her hiding her identity. Likewise, why did you refuse to bow to Haman? And again, we could speculate. A lot of people have said, well, he would only bow to God. Well, there is a lot of bowing going on in the Old Testament that's just a form of respect. I mean, Esther is going to bow before the king later on in this very book. And so bowing in itself isn't necessarily worship. So maybe that's what it was and maybe it's not. But the narrator doesn't even give us a hint as to what Mordecai's motivation was. He's a very deep and enigmatic guy in the book of Esther. But Ahasuerus is not that. His thoughts are obvious to everyone. And whereas Haman's thoughts become obvious, they're only obvious because the narrator tells us what he was thinking. Ahasuerus is just so superficial that everybody knows exactly what he's thinking. He gets angry and everybody knows in chapter 1 and in chapter 7. His anger subsides and it's obvious in chapter 2 and in chapter 7. He's pleased in chapter 1:21 with the advice that he gets. And he's pleased with the advice that he gets in chapter 2 about bringing in all of the virgins and having that little contest. And he's pleased when he sees Esther and he loves her and he favors her. And he's easily read by you as you read the book of Esther. You see exactly what's going on in his mind all of the time because he's so incredibly superficial. But he's also easily read by people around him. His advisors know exactly what's going on and they come up with the exact right thing to say that he's going to jump on immediately because they read him like a book. And the eunuchs in chapter 2, they see exactly what's going on in his mind and they give him advice that immediately pleases him as well, as does Haman and as does Esther and as does Esther and Mordecai later on in chapter 8. Basically, everybody reads him like a book and bends him to their wills immediately because his moods and his motives are obvious to everybody and he has no real deeper resources than that in the book of Esther. He's a superficial guy. And he's also a guy who is obsessed with honor. Now, honor and shame were an important part of culture in the ancient world and they're an important part of this story. The banquets that he has in chapter 1, as we talked about last night, is a way of flaunting his wealth and his power to the empire so that they would honor him. The fact that he invites nobles and officials from all over the place and even commoners to come see his glory is a way of building his own honor. And just when his honor is put on display, his queen Vashti dishonors him. And so in response to the dishonor that she gives him, he writes a law that all wives must honor their husband. He is obsessed with this. And Haman is going to prod the king's ego in chapter 3. There's this unnamed nation that he wants to destroy. Why? Well, they don't obey the laws of the king. Oh, they don't obey my laws. You see, what Haman's doing is working on this honor that the king is obsessed with. And Esther also, she'll do the same thing. You know, if we'd been merely sold as slaves, I wouldn't even bother wasting your time. Because my little affliction and the affliction of my people, if they'd been sold into slavery, isn't even worth wasting your time about. That's playing to his honor as well. And in relation to Mordecai, when the king forgot to honor Mordecai for saving his life, that was something that would have brought shame on him. And the king is just constantly obsessed with this. And the way that he tries to purchase this honor is by his generosity. And he is generous to a fault. I mean, quite literally, he is generous to a fault. The things that he does backfire on him something severely. But the feast that he is constantly throwing is a manifestation of this generosity to lavish this hospitality on all of these people who came to witness his glory. The tax holiday that is given when Esther is chosen to be queen, that is a way of lavishing this generosity on people as well. He gives Haman the signet ring and tells him he can write whatever he wants to write. He tells Esther multiple times, I'll give you whatever you want, even up to half of my kingdom. And of course, that's kind of court language. It wasn't to be taken literally if she said, oh, that sounds good. I think I'll take half of your kingdom. Probably she wouldn't have gotten it. It's just a way of saying, I'll give you whatever you want. Within reason, of course, being the subtext there. But again, it's a very gracious offer to make there. And with Mordecai as well, there's this great need for him to show generosity to the person who saved his life. And in talking to Haman, he gives Haman basically a blank check. What is it that you think should be done for the man the king delights to honor? And one of the funniest scenes in the entire Bible, Haman says, well, who could the king want to honor more than me? And he comes up with this brilliant plan, which is tantamount to treason. I don't know if you've thought of this before, but in the ancient world, nobody wore the king's clothes but the king, and no one rode on the king's horse but the king. And so when Haman says, this person you want to honor, and he's thinking about himself, give him clothing that the king has worn and put him on the back of the horse that the king has worn, decked out in full regalia of the king, and have this noble person walk before him saying, this is what the king does for people he wants to honor. He's basically committing treason there in his own mind. He's someone that has royal aspirations himself, but he is willing to let this happen. Not for Haman, but for Mordecai. And again, this is kind of a lavish generosity that is beyond the pale in the ancient world. The same thing is true with the Jewish people as well. He acts like he saved the Jews' life when you get to chapter 8 and read the edict that is written. But here's the problem. When you have somebody that is superficial and is obsessed with honor and is generous in this way, what it leads to is a whole lot of irresponsibility. Someone who's really nervous about having honor and keeping honor, and someone who is demonstratively generous like this, what happens very often is they give away too much to try to keep that honor. And you see that in one regard with the fact that everybody else's will becomes the law. In chapter 1, Memucan, one of the advisors, he says, hey, king, this is what we should do. And the king goes, oh, sounds good to me. We'll do that. In chapter 3, Haman says, hey, king, this is what we should do. And he goes, yeah, that sounds great. We'll do that. Harbona says, hang Haman on his own gallows. Well, that's not a law, technically speaking, but it's about as irreversible as the other decisions were. And the king says, yeah, that sounds great. We'll do that. And then he says to Esther and Mordecai, you can write whatever you want. You've got the king's signet ring. Again, whoever wants to do anything in this empire, the king just hands it away. I mean, you stop and you think about this for a moment. The king should be thinking, and fortunately for Esther and Mordecai, he wasn't thinking. But what he should be thinking is, the last time I gave my prime minister a blank check in my signet ring, he wrote a really, really bad edict that has caused all kinds of problems. Maybe I shouldn't do that again. But what Ahasuerus says is, wow, we got a real problem here. Haman wrote this really bad edict. Here, Mordecai, here's my signet ring. Write whatever you want to write. It's utterly ridiculous for a king to behave in this kind of way. He never says no. He surrenders his power to whoever can push the right buttons. I mean, you stop and you think about it. In chapter 1, he says yes to Memucan. In chapter 2, the eunuchs advise him and he says yes to them. In chapter 3, Haman advises him and he says yes to Haman. In chapter 5, he says yes to Esther. In chapter 6, he says yes to Haman. In chapter 7, he says yes to Esther. In chapter 7, he says yes to Harbona. In chapter 8, he says yes to Esther and Mordecai. And in chapter 9, he says yes to Esther. So aside from chapter 4 and chapter 10, he's doing someone else's will every step of the way. And this is the guy who is in charge of the most powerful nation in the entire world. And maybe another way of saying that he is irresponsible is to say that he's lazy. He doesn't expend any energy. He doesn't expend any thought on really anything. He follows the advice of whoever gives it as soon as the person gives it. There's no critical thought. There's no discussion. There's no weighing of pros and cons. The moment someone says we should do this, he says, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. He doesn't really know what's going on, and he doesn't really care what he's getting himself into or what the consequences will be. He never bothers with inquiries. I mean, the classic case of this is in chapter 3. If you want to look in chapter 3, this is as bad as it gets. Chapter 3 and verse 8. Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there's a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business. that they may put it into the king's treasury. So the king took a signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money is given to you and the people also to do with them as it seems good to you. You stop and you think about this. Here is your right-hand man, who you have some confidence in, obviously. But he comes in and says, there's this group of people out there. They're scattered abroad. Their laws are different. It's not in the king's profit to tolerate them. I'll pay 10,000 talents, which is about half of the Persian Empire's annual tax revenue, by the way. This is an exorbitant sum of money. I'll pay about 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of the king to destroy them all. Now, what are maybe some questions that you think the king should ask here? Anybody? We'll have some discussion now.
Who are these people?
Number one question is the obvious one. Who is it that we are going to be killing? That's a really good question to ask. And he never does. So much so that when, you know, Mordecai the Jew shows up in this record book in chapter 6 as the person who has saved his life, he never stops and says, the Jews, we're killing these guys. Something's not right here. He never knows who it is that they're going to be killing. That's a really important question to ask. Any other good questions that he maybe should have asked?
Where's the evidence?
And in particular, the evidence of these allegations, and Haman's really crafty here. We'll talk about Haman later on this week. But the way that he approaches this, it's that it begins with a little bit of truth and gets farther and farther from the truth as it goes. It's a very well-devised approach to this issue. But where's the evidence? Oh, they're scattered and dispersed among the peoples. Okay, well, that's true. There's evidence of that. But in particular, they don't keep the king's laws, and it's not in the king's profit to tolerate them. Okay, who are these people, first of all, and show me how they don't keep the king's laws, and show me how it's not in the king's interest to tolerate them. You know, there's a really good piece of evidence that it was in the king's interest to tolerate them. Who's the one that Haman is most angry with? Mordecai, of course, right? And what does Mordecai do at the end of chapter 2? He saves the king's life. Is it in the king's best interest to tolerate him? You better believe it is. And things are going to get a whole lot better when Mordecai is second in command. It's absolutely in the king's best interest. And so, show me how it's not. You know, show me how their laws are different and how they're so nefariously different at that. Because just because they're different doesn't mean there's something bad going on there, right? So there's a lot of questions. Another one, you know, where are you going to get this money? You're talking about a whole lot of money. Where are you going to get this money from to pay into the king's treasuries to kill these people? Well, there's a lot of questions, but he doesn't even seem to think to ask any of them. All that he does is he says, okay, sounds good to me. Here's my signet ring. You can take care of this. And you get an idea of just how lazy and indifferent and irresponsible he is when you get to chapter 7. Because Esther, at this point, will say to the king, my people have been sold to destruction. Actually, let me flip over there and read this. We have been sold, verse 4, chapter 7. We have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. And there are a couple of things going on there that should clue him in as to exactly what it is she's talking about. First of all, that they have been sold. Remember the 10,000 talents? They have been sold. She points back to this being a business transaction of some kind. But then also to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. That is a direct quotation from the edict that Haman wrote. And so, first of all, Ahasuerus, if he had any responsibility at all, would know that this is language from the edict that he has authorized, but he doesn't. But worse than that, he asks the question, who is it that has done this? Now, at some point, what the king should say is, you know what? I probably haven't signed off on that many edicts of genocide over the last couple of months. I know exactly what's going on here. But here is a man who is so lazy and irresponsible and oblivious to what is going on in his own nation that it's as if he's been signing this sort of thing every day and there are 15 different nations slated to be destroyed and he doesn't know which one the queen's talking about. Well, that's certainly not the case. But again, it gives you something of a picture of who this guy is and how little he seems to care about much of anything. I mean, his grand decisions that he makes, other than the two silly laws we've already talked about, his grand decisions are to allocate power elsewhere. Here, Haman, do whatever you want. Here, Mordecai, do whatever you want. And beyond that, other people just exploit his moods and feed him ideas that match his mood and do exactly what he's going to do anyway. And again, what you wind up with is a terrifying situation. This king is something of a buffoon, as I said. He's a comical figure in a lot of ways. But it's easy to laugh at him several thousand years later. It would be terrifying to live under his rule. I mean, so little of an impression does this edict of extermination make that he forgets about it just a few days later. It's a terrifying sort of person to live under. And on top of that, he winds up being someone who is imprisoned to basically everything. Everything else is running his decisions. And maybe there's something practical to think about along these lines as well, is if you live this kind of superficial life of irresponsibility and laziness in your thinking, you're going to wind up being enslaved to everything and everybody else. You might think that that's the easy path to freedom and not having to work very hard, but yeah, maybe so, but it's only because other people are managing your life for you at every point of the way. Look at this man. He is a prisoner to his anger. Every time he gets angry, it forces him to make a decision of some kind. Forces may not be the best word there, but it certainly leads him directly to that. He's angry with Vashti and he kicks her out. Now he's got a problem. He doesn't have a queen anymore and he has to solve that issue. But he's also a prisoner of his women in his life. His desire to show off his first queen is what leads to the fiasco in chapter 1. His desire for a new queen leads to an even more controlling queen. His desire to please her leads him to making the same dumb decision that he made before with Haman. Although, again, it works out in the Jews' favor, and so it's good for God's people. But he's also a prisoner to his advisors. I mean, he seems to be unable to do anything on his own unless he's being told to do something. Everyone else is constantly managing his life. And that's the king that we find here in the book of Esther. And again, he doesn't seem to have the evil motives of Haman. But however benign he might seem to be, it is his callous indifference to genocide that leads to everything that goes on in the book. And it reminds us then that evil is not only a trait of the people who initiate evil. Evil is not only a trait of the people who perpetrate evil, but it's also a trait of those who facilitate evil by their agreement with evil or by their passivity in relationship to evil. And this is what I want to spend some time thinking about. I'll say a few things and then we'll open this up for some discussion, and hopefully we'll have sufficient discussion because I managed to leave myself a fair amount of time, to my surprise. But let me talk about it in this way. Obviously, we're never, I hope, going to be in a situation where whether or not genocide is committed hangs in the balance on our say-so. It's, I mean, beyond unlikely that we are ever going to be in that scenario. But there are a variety of ways that evil is around us on a daily basis. And the question is, from which sins do we look the other way and pretend like it's not there and passively and indifferently let it go on and support it by not saying anything when we have opportunity to do so? Now, let me address this from a couple of perspectives before we have some discussion on it. You may hear people say from time to time, well, Jesus associated with sinners all the time, and so maybe we should associate with sinners. But, did Jesus associate with sinners and look the other way? Did Jesus associate with sinners and act like their sin was no big deal? I mean, when Jesus associated with sinners, he was preaching a message of repentance. He would go there and heal the lame man and say, stop sinning lest something worse happen to you. He would forgive the adulterous woman, but then say, stop sinning. Go your way and sin no more. I mean, a constant part of Jesus' message wasn't, nah, no big deal, you know, everyone can do whatever they want to do. No skin off my back. It was a very big deal, and that's what the heart of Jesus' message was. And so, going to sinners to preach to sinners, going to sinners to show love to sinners in a Christ-like sacrificial way, that's very, very good. But there's a difference between teaching sinners, which is what Jesus did, and just hanging out with the impenitent who openly reject Jesus and who openly reject God, which he did not do. He didn't just go shoot the breeze with sinners because that seemed like a good way to spend some time. I mean, he was a physician that went to the sick. He wasn't their best buddy that went to the sick. And so what I would say along these lines is three things. First of all, we must not be indifferent about sin. Because being indifferent about sin in this kind of way is tantamount to approval to sin. Jesus came to draw the sinner out of his sin, not to just hang out with the guy. He came as a doctor to cure the sin, not a best friend to socialize with the sinner. We must not be indifferent about sin. And one of the reasons why we must not be indifferent about sin, and the second thing I'll talk about, is how that impacts our influence. Because if there is somebody who is openly sinning and openly rejecting God and Jesus, and we just don't care about that, and we're perfectly fine with that, and we spend all of our time with that kind of person without ever saying anything about that sin in that kind of way, what it is saying to the sinful person is, well, my behavior must be okay with him. My behavior must be okay with her. There's nothing else they could get out of it other than we think it's okay on some level. If it was really, really a problem that we thought would lead their souls to destruction, surely we would have said something. And it's not just that sinful person that it speaks volumes about what we think about that person. What about those who respect you? What about your children who look up to you? Or other young people who look up to you? What does it say about your perspective on that evil? Well, it must be okay with him. It should be okay to me then as well. And maybe it's not okay with you, and maybe you are making some effort to try to help this person. But at the same time, you have to make it clear that the sin is sin. Because otherwise, the impact that you will have on everybody, the sinner and those who look up to you, and anyone else who is watching, is that this sin is perfectly fine with this person. And the impact is an impact for evil, it's not an impact for good. And that brings us then third to the question that we asked last night when we talked about justice and the judgment fitting the crime. And that is, do we really want God in our lives or don't we? And do we really want a God-filled life? How many times have you heard someone say, would you go watch that movie if Jesus were there with you? Or something along those lines. You hear that kind of question. And the reason why you hear that kind of question all the time, the reason it's become such a cliche, is because it's a fantastic question to ask. You really should think about those kinds of things. Because, of course, Jesus is with you. But you might add to that, would I spend all day hanging out with an openly sinful person without ever addressing his or her sin with Jesus? Because Jesus wouldn't have done that. Jesus would have never spent hours upon hours upon hours with someone who is openly rejecting God and never addressed the fact that that person is rejecting God. There is no example anywhere in the New Testament that looks anything like that at all. And the bottom line is, when we are indifferent to sin, it might not be genocide that is committed at the end, but somebody's soul might still die at the end of the day. There is an evil to indifference, because indifference says that evil is okay. It says that that's what you really think. It tells the sinner that that's what you think. And it tells everyone who would follow in your path that that's what you think. And that is something that we must not do in our lives. We must take a stand with God, because His stand is the only one that matters. All right, that's kind of a general way of talking about this. I may regret this later on, but let's open this up for some discussion and maybe talk about some more specifics. Is there anything in particular that that comes to anyone's mind? Maybe situations in life or anything else along those lines that we can talk about along this path? Yes, sir.
I thought it was interesting that you actually used the phrase that certainly there will be genocide based on our say-so. And yet in our country, genocide is done every day. And religious people, Catholics, Jews who should know better than to kill innocent people that have no rights, should know better, have learned that lesson, support people who put people on the Supreme Court that keep the murdering the unborn children. And I believe they're all going to answer for that.
That is a very good point. I said, and I hadn't thought through this particular example, our word may not have anything to do with genocide at some point in the future, but there is this going on in our country on an ongoing basis as unborn children are being killed by the thousands and millions over time. And there are people, religious people, that support people who believe that. And I don't want to get political here. Of course, there's no politician who is perfect and all of them support something that is bad in some way. And I don't want to go down that road. But here is certainly a way that people are in our culture openly saying, yeah, it's fine to kill an entire group of helpless people. It's a good thought. What else? Anything else here? Probably should have asked you if this was a talkative group before I decided to do this. Yes, sir.
It makes you wonder how the king took over all these other nations.
Yeah, it does. And I think, I guess I should repeat this for anyone that couldn't hear it. It makes you wonder how the king took over all these other nations. And I think this goes back to the point that I was making, that the overall character of this man was probably not this ridiculous. And there's a sense probably in which any of us, if you chose a certain set of behaviors in us, or a certain group of decisions that we've made over a shorter, maybe even a longer time, we could look pretty ridiculous as well. And so I think what's going on here is not that Ahasuerus, or Xerxes as he's known also, was not this bad of a king overall. But again, the point is this satirical part of the story where pagan rulers are being panned as ridiculous and powerful people are being shown as not having any power. And all of this is pointing somewhere else. If these people don't have power, if these people have no wisdom at all, where is real power? Where is real wisdom to be found? And it's a subtle way of pointing you back to the God of the Jews who is saving them over the course of this book. But it really does. I mean, if even half of his character is as ridiculous as it looks in the book of Esther, it does make you wonder. And the answer is, he didn't. Several other kings before him did, and he just inherited it. So, and his decision to invade Greece wasn't a good one. That's going to come back and bite the Persians later on. And that's really more, how did he remain in power for so long without someone coming to take over? More of a historical sort of question that we'll jump to the side of, not to ignore your question, your point. But it is an interesting thing to think about, this person. You have your hand up.
Yeah, I was just going to say, maybe follow the example of a lot of people where they try to surround themselves by good people. And so then he puts his trust in those good people to make the right decisions. Together, at least through the 10 years that are covered, or whatever, through the book of Esther.
Yeah, and that's one of those things as well, is who do you surround yourself with? Do you surround yourself with good people that will help you, or, you know, bad people that will lead you astray? And that still comes back to some of this irresponsibility and laziness. Even if you have good advisors, you really should critically think about their advice. Even if you trust them implicitly, if you are running a nation, or even if you're not running a nation, if you're running a company, or even if you're not running a company, if you're just the head of your own family, if you're in a position of authority, which everyone probably is to some degree somewhere at some point in their lives, you have to do critical thinking or you're going to make really bad decisions. And they may not be evil decisions necessarily. They may not be sinful decisions, but they can really damage a lot of people in a lot of ways if you don't really think things through. Is that just a scratch or was that a move? Okay. I wasn't sure if you were getting ready.
You were talking about if you have somebody that's sinful, you can't hang around with them without saying something, mm-hmm. okay? How long do you do that? Is there a point where you give up? When do you pull the reins back and say, okay, you shake the dust from your feet?
That's a very good question. That kind of gets to more of a practical sort of thing. This goes back to the point that I was making. Watch where I'm stepping, sorry. The point that I was making about, you know, being indifferent about evil in other people's lives around you. And, you know, Jesus doesn't just hang out with sinners to shoot the breeze. You know, where in your life, in your relationship with somebody, do you say, and that's enough. I've worked hard with you. I've tried to teach you, and you're not listening to anything that I say. And our friendship really needs to end because you keep rejecting God. And I'm a Christian, and I can't reject God. And at some point, friendship with the world is enmity with God. You know, where is that point? And my short answer is, it's really hard to draw hard and fast line that everyone has to follow in every situation. You know, you tell them three times, and if they don't buy it at that point, then you cut them off. I don't know that you can say anything that firm about it. Maybe this is a good thing to discuss. We have elders in the audience who are wiser than I am, more experienced preacher than I, and a whole lot of people who probably dealt with people in their own lives. What are your thoughts here? What do we need?
Well, like you say, that it's different for different people. Mm-hmm. Depends on how frequently you see the person, what kind of stuff you do with the person. Do you have some family obligations to them? Is it your spouse? Is it your one of your children? One of your parents? Whatever. All those play into the factor. But at some point, you should be able to tell that the person thinks that you think, basically, although you're displeased with them, that you're okay and your relationship with them is not going to permanently change. And when that's apparent, that that's the view that they take, you have to show them that that's not true. That there is a permanent change. That it can't go on any longer.
What else here? Yes, sir.
As a Christian, you know what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, salt of the earth and light of the world. So, in those associations,
something that both of you kind of said in different ways that I'll repeat for whoever couldn't hear everything and for the recording as well, if this is being recorded, is the idea of some kind of progress being made. If you are making progress with them, if they're not influencing you in the wrong way, or if things haven't settled to the point that they think that you're okay with things and your relationship hasn't settled that way, if you're making progress with this person, then you keep working with this person. But what you can't do is not even try to make progress. And that's a lot of what I'm talking about here. Or stagnate. As long as you are telling them that sin is wrong and they are sinning in a wrong way, I mean, however you need to do that in the context of the relationship, then you're making progress in the right direction. And what you might find sometimes is this situation solves itself. To answer the question, it solves itself because eventually they get tired of being told they need to change their life. And they're the ones who, if the progress stops, they're going to be cutting off the relationship, not you. And so that might be part of it as well. Yes, sir. One last comment. And if you really care about the person, those are going to be the kinds of things you do. You're not going to have these traits of this king. You're going to not be indifferent about the sin. You're going to be working to save the person if you really care. And that's the problem with this king, is he didn't really care about much of anything. And that's what we have to avoid, is that kind of indifference and the evil that it can lead to. I'm sorry, I'm out of time. I'm really out of time. So we'll chat after. Okay. All right. Speaking of caring and not caring, that gives me a nice segue to our invitation song. Because whereas this king was a king who did not care about much of anything at any point, we serve a Savior who does and who did. And he showed that by giving his life for us. He showed that by preaching a message of repentance. I made the comment a little while ago that Jesus acted or didn't act as if it wasn't any skin off his back when someone sinned. And I realized as I said that, every sin was literally skin off his back. It mattered deeply to him, and he cared enough about us that he was willing to do that. And remember that as you live your life, as you interact with your friends who are sinners, as we all are in some way, that this is what he gave for them, this is what he gave for us, and he cared so deeply that he was willing to do so, and he still cares, and he is still there to help you in your life. And this is the Savior that we serve, and this is the Savior that you could serve as well. And we offer the invitation to anyone who needs to make Jesus the Lord of their life and give themselves over to him to be their Savior. You need to come to him and be baptized into him. To give your life to him, confess him as the Lord of your life. If there's some way that we can help you this evening, won't you let it be known as together we stand and sing.